Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage. I'm Adam Lowry. Today we are powered by SWATMMA.com. That's my friends Jeff and Julian at SWAT MMA Extreme and Fitness in Winter Garden, Florida.
With me today is Dr. Parker Mott, a psychologist, and Eric Rittenberry, a socio-political philosopher.
For me, you know, getting you guys together was something I've been wanting to do for a long fucking time. Since I got back, or even before I got back.
Yeah, man, we've been planning this a long time. Talking on the phone.
Yeah, debunking shit. I think we were even attacking people on Facebook. We were grouping up in threes, man.
Facebook didn't have a, it didn't have a chance against our friends at that point. It was pretty bad when all three of us were going at it.
Yeah, what was that?
There was a couple posts, man.
When our minds all line up, it's
well, it's bad though. I mean, yeah, we came at a couple people for a couple posts, but we didn't mean to. It was, you know, I would even try not to respond on some of them. There would be some posts I'm going, you know what? I'm not going to say a fucking thing. Yeah. I'm not saying anything here. And then one of you fuckers would post something, and I would go, he couldn't hold it. All right, well, since he couldn't hold it, I'm going to let this shit go now, too. And you usually pop off first, Eric. You usually pop off first.
In a respectful manner, I could pop off.
I disagree. In a very awesome manner. I don't know. Yeah. Forgive the vocabulary.
It's basically an intellectual slap to the face.
It is.
But it opens it up for, hey, come back with something, because, you know, I'm not saying it's a certainty. You know what I mean? That's the biggest thing.
That's the trick, though, I think. People posting, because it's hard not to post something, especially for me, shit. Hell, I go on Joe Rogan and state dumb shit as facts, and it's not exactly fact when you're talking moments. So even for me, you know, trying to separate.
At what moment did it dawn on you that somebody was going to call you out on something like that?
Literally?
In the moment.
I can tell you when. The moment I went, and he goes, oh, so Heron's like the boxer, and I went, same thing! Right after I did that.
No, dude, I told you on the way here. I was like, I know he was probably freaking out a little bit in his head going, fuck, because he's answering quick. Mm-hmm. I'm talking, Joe Rogan, the eye. Question, but a question, all of a sudden, boom, answer. Question, bam, answer. It was, you weren't even thinking about it.
You were right.
It was like, boom. I'm like, whew. He didn't even do this.
I didn't even think, man. And for me, it was more, you know, when I did respond, like you said, Parker, when I was like, it's the same thing. Well, look, we all know that when someone lies, the pitch of the voice goes up.
The pitch goes
up. And you break the eye contact. Well, watch me on the camera, and I was like, so we're just trading out heroin for the thing. And I went, same thing. I look up and to the left, my voice pitch goes high, and right then is when I went, I'm fucked. I said that, and I was like, I'm fucked. Once I realized I was fucked and I said that, I said, well, fuck, I'm going to go all out then. I'm going to go all out. And, you know, I spoke in generalizations. I spoke in generalizations mainly if you're in the conversation to the tone and the
I thought it was pretty specific. I didn't think it was as generalized. I think you definitely took a position and ran with it. And I was like, you committed to it. You said, I'm going in this direction. And all out, 100%, I'm going in this direction.
That sounds like me. Even if it's the fucking holy shit direction.
Even you had Joe Rogan going, no fucking way.
No, look, the Suboxone, the way it came from and the way it came to be is true. Even the naysayers on the comments on YouTube verified that.
Now,
the sword picture, that is the second Suboxone. That is not the first Suboxone, but sitting there, I couldn't remember. Mm-hmm. And when he pulled up, and I said, no, it's a cross. I know it. I know it's a Christian cross, because look, there's another side to that story on Joe Rogan nobody ever heard about. And it's not the story that I was a heroin addict. You know, there's another story to that. So when he pulled up the one and it came to be a sword, I went, in my mind, I went, meant to be both. And I'm like, no, that's not the original one. But I couldn't quite remember it. And these guys got Google at their fingertips, you know,
yeah.
It was already there. And then I did my own research, and you got to go like 20-something pages back to find the original Suboxone pill. Now, I don't know, okay, and I don't want to start any shit, but how much money do you got to pay to get images removed from the internet, right?
You have to have a good company to do it.
You
go
do
and
so.
Sweep it.
That's right. And so what
and
happened?
Celebrities.
Well, the reason we knew it is because, all right, when the Christian Cross press came out, that was first. And it didn't last long because everybody kind of caught on to what they were doing. And then they restamped it, and because on the street, when you would sell the Suboxone to anybody, it was known as the nail in the coffin. And so the second Suboxone that came out was the nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
And the first one was the miracle drug with the cross. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't remember it right then. So I wanted to go, that's not it, Jamie. But I played, I just sat there, and I, for the one thing I didn't just spit out, right? I just sat there, you know?
Yeah.
So that was true. I mean, everything I said to a point was true, except the notion that heroin is exactly like Suboxone.
Well, yeah, I think you definitely took a direction, and you ran with it. I think it was just that some of the people who were probably upset saw it from, it's not just this direction, you know, you're just kind of focusing on this and not looking at the other side as well.
And that was the truth. And the point I really missed, I do regret not being my complete positive, motivated self like I usually am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually that guy that, you know, you can do it without anything, but I came across as this negative conspiracy theorist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I kind of did that point, and the positive me left, which was the notion that, look, I understand the boxing can help people do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to take away from that at all. But the notion still is that it is an opiate. And even though it has an inhibitor, it's still an opiate. So if us three, which don't do heroin, unless you started some, I don't know. I mean, we don't do heroin. If we all took the Suboxone, we would feel that feeling. We would feel that opiate feeling.
To a certain extent.
But you still would.
Because it can be a pain reducer. It can be a pain reliever.
Now that leads me into my biggest point, and what I couldn't put together was, you know as well as I know, is a lot of the people being treated in these facilities, it's not just one drug. It's not the drug of choice, as they like to call it. It's whatever's available. And so it may be heroin that week, or that's the reason they need to rehab now, but it's also clonopins and dilaudids, and it's a lot of other things, oxys, it's a mix. And so the notion is, sure, you only truly die from a Suboxone overdose when it's mixed, agreed. But these people have... I will generalize and say a lot of them have a cocktail of medications they're taking, and chronic pain is rampant in this demographic. And so with chronic pain being rampant, you've got tons of opiates already flowing through them generally. Sometimes they use the Suboxone to also treat the pain because it's an opiate, you know, birds in one stone here. But if you do that, the pain receptors themselves stop defending themselves. And so the minute you may use the Suboxone to help wean you off of using heroin like it's supposed to. If you're going to take it your whole life, then you're still not drug-free. It's still an opiate. But if you use it to wean yourself off of the heroin, then the pain receptors stop defending themselves, essentially. And so once you stop the Suboxone, the pain you've always had, the chronic pain, now feels worse than it did before.
Oh, absolutely.
So what follows behind more pain behind that, I've now quit my Suboxone, is called relapse. And now I turn to stronger opiates because my chronic pain now feels worse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when I said that people die from it, it's like heroin, I was generalizing the dangers of handing people that are duly diagnosed, that are already taking a cocktail of medications and have a history of taking God knows what, from alcohol to opiates to heroin to meth, and then saying here's 90 more opiates that are, they inhibit you from feeling the craving, but it's also helping you with your chronic pain, which is great, but the minute you wean off of it, your pain is going to feel worse than it did when you went on it, and I hope you don't relapse on opiates to fight that chronic pain now that feels worse than it did.
Do you know the name of that theory? It's either called the opposite opponent process theory, or the opposite theory, and it's basically the opposite, the withdrawal of any drug is the opposite of what it's intended to do. So if you're taking anti-anxiety to help with anxiety, if you get off of it, it goes the other way. And it's the same thing with the pain medications. And a lot of times, when you come off of the pain medications, you're going to experience more pain than if you did kind of normal. It kind of shoots up like a peak, but then over time it balances out. But that shooting up of the pain is sometimes what keeps people continuing to use pain medications. Is just to prevent that peak, and that peak is what you talk about when you say that people will relapse. Is that they experience actual symptoms, whether it's anxiety or pain or whatnot, that, you know, in maybe twice as much as they normally would. So it's kind of that rebalancing effect, and it's a physiological component of the receptors in your body kind of trying to rebalance themselves.
So, and Yeah, thank you. That's thank you for clarifying and being able to say it more scientific than I could. And I think people expected when they heard a mental health counselor coming on was a guy that was going to come on and talk like either a Dr. Rhonda Patrick or talk like that. And so when the guy like me comes down, he's like, fuck this and fuck that. All of a sudden, the Masters is a quack guy that doesn't know what he's talking about. And the truth is, I mean, that's who the fuck I really am, you know? And so people make assumptions because of titles about how the fuck you're supposed to talk. But you clarify that better than my words ever can, you know? And so in doing so, that's really what I meant. And if anything, to draw attention to the fact that the system is what's broken. You know, I didn't want to attack the so-called addict like it sounded like I was doing. I even said on there one time that the addicts are treated like five-star guests at the Ritz-Carlton. And that's not what I meant. That came across way wrong. What I was trying to say is a lot of the patients there act as if they're guests at the five-star Ritz-Carlton. So we try to provide that kind of coverage. I know those hospitals do, but for one, it's not. Most of those facilities are shit. But compared to being homeless, it's great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but what ends up happening is the patients there demand from the therapist what is and what isn't, what will happen and what won't happen. And so as a therapist, you're trying to go, look, I'm trying to plan for you and help you. I think this is better therapeutically for you to stay here another week. But no, they want to leave. You know, someone they met or fell in love with is leaving. So they try to prolong it. And so what they start doing is ordering extensions on their own. You know what I mean? They order their own extensions. And so we're a therapist caught in the middle, and then the administrators would step in and say, hey, look, it's okay. We'll get you what you want. Just extend them. Because they got days and they're paying.
Right.
Right? So administration would make calls that a therapist would advise against.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant by treating like five-star patients. And we were basically their travel planner, meaning I'm their case manager and a therapist. Meaning it is true. I have to find their halfway house where they're going to live. I have to find the doctor that's going to give them the Suboxone medication, which is hard to find these days. I have to do that for them. That is all real.
Right.
And then, so for me, it's really the system I should have focused on.
Yes.
Not the patient, because I feel for the patient. I'm out here screaming for that patient.
Well, I could see that, and I think anybody who watched the Joe Rogan show saw that, at least I hope they did, they saw that. I think you were coming from the point of frustration for the client.
And the therapist.
And the therapist, because I think specifically, and I've worked in substance abuse treatment for inpatient and outpatient, and I understand the struggles, the frustration, and going home and feeling like you didn't do a lot that day. It is a struggle, and unfortunately, you know, part of it does have to do with the insurance companies, the system, the state, all of those providing quality health care, you know, government-run things. And that was primarily, you know, I don't know about the facility you worked in, but most of the substance abuse treatment facilities, at least on the community health level, are government-funded in some ways, whether it's a non-for-profit or state-funded. And it's, you know, the five-star resort ones are the ones in Boca, Miami, the ones that are private pay where people can drop, you know, $60,000-$70,000 into a treatment program. You know, if you have money, you basically are kind of screwed sometimes because you're excluded from any sort of government programs, but it's really the government funding. And once you start at the government level and work down, you know, sometimes the quality isn't there, and it has nothing to do with the quality of all the mental health care workers out there. There's good ones, there's bad ones, but they're all out on the front lines of mental health, trying to fight this beast. And they're handicapped in a lot of ways. And it's not their fault, you know.
And that's kind of what I'm speaking to, are those patients that become patients, I should say, those people that think they're doing the right thing because they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so the right thing in a family these days is if you're dealing with a family member that's dealing with drugs per se, the idea is this intervention, right? I had a couple families come to me before and ask me about interventions. No, I say, no, I'm not a fan, okay? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not a fan at all. But these are the notions that the people understand. The people understand that, okay, you have a problem. We have to confront you and send you away.
Right.
Well, I'll ask you, Eric, if one of your children had a drug problem, would you send them to someone else to fix it? You see?
Yeah.
And that my point is that is it's not that the fact that they're not doing the right thing that they think they know.
Right.
But to treat someone that's dealing with drugs, mm-hmm. for one, in a 30-day inpatient facility, let's completely enable someone that's already enabled themselves,
mm-hmm.
and perpetuate this enabled feeling that I can't do anything, and coach them along the way, do everything for them, essentially,
yeah.
and then put them around people that are experiencing the same things we are. Now, I can't argue nature and nurture. But you take someone in that frail state of mind and put them around another 180 people in their same state of mind.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then after 30 days, I plan everything for them, and then I make them now dependent on another pill and send them on their way.
What's the success rate of them recovering from that? Do you know? Is there a number?
It's low.
It's low, right?
You know, out of the groups that I would run, sometimes if there was 10 or 15 20 people in the group, I would say the success rate was probably 1 to 3 in every mm-hmm. 10 to 20. It's a program that
pretty much fails, but it's still funded continually, and there's no changes ever taking place. They never rethink the philosophy or rethink anything.
They rethink it on a government level based on finances,
right.
and based on...
Usually when government programs like that fail, mm-hmm. you know, like the free market, what would happen when something would fail? You know, they're done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're out of business, right? Well, government programs, all they have to do is yell out, you know, oh, they're not getting enough funding. So, you know, you fund, and you keep on funding the failure.
Mm-hmm.
They just put out another $5 billion to fund more mental health facilities just like this.
And they're going to do the same thing, though, right? As Joe Rogan says, less government.
Well, it's true. And, you know, what I said on there is the shroud of it's helpful. Mm-hmm. At least the awareness is there, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really wanted to attack is the system that's in place to help the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that system that's in place is broken. And
right.
if you asked me my recovery rate, I would tell you 2%. And I can tell you from the 2 years I put in at this facility, it goes unnamed.
Mm-hmm.
The roster that I had, because you never forget your first roster as a therapist. When you come on as the full therapist, and now we were doing rosters of 22, mind you, okay?
That's way too much.
Exactly.
Way too much.
Exactly. And now it would range, vary. And so we're sitting there with 22, and now I'm nervous. You know, I was hired now, mind you, before I even graduated. They offered me a job. I had some decent group skills.
Mm-hmm.
And we start to do this group, and I can tell you that my whole roster from I started, I saw every one of those faces again.
Hmm.
Every one of them. The shocker, within 3 months.
Hmm.
And I saved this paperwork for a while until I left there to remind me that, you know, we can think we're coming in to do a lot of good and make a lot of changes. And we can think we're good at things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what pointed out the system being broken. I had to look at the system itself.
Right.
And so when I walked in and I looked at my list of 22 patients, a few of those names I knew from practicum mm-hmm. and internship, you know, they had already had a history. Hell, they call them frequent flyers and alumni. They call them that.
Yep.
3 months later, I'm looking at the same roster that I began with, and give or take 3 or 4 names, it's the same people. In 3 months, Eric. That's the truth.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of repeat people as well.
Now, that pointed the broken system to me. That's when I went, wait a minute. And I started looking at what happened, how they got treated, how I was being treated. You know, and as a therapist, your hands are tied, dude. I mean,
yeah.
you go pay $100,000 for a master's degree. You're lucky, because if you're not licensed, you got 2 years to get licensed anyway. You come out with a master's after this, you're lucky to find somewhere to pay you $38,000 a year to do therapy. And they can pay you that because you don't have a license.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll give you free licensure over 2 years. Work for us for 38. After you get licensed, we'll move you to 45.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you did 5 years, and you're coming out at 45. And then you walk into a place after 5 years, and you realize the administration is not on your team. They're there to keep the patients happy and keep down grievances.
Right.
So they keep them happy as long as you got days. Now, if you don't got days and you start shit, administration will back you up, buddy. They will be out of there. Now, you got days? I've seen people fighting being threats to other patients allowed to stay and other patients sent home because they didn't have the days, right? But they would come up with some real way to
right.
do that.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So then you walk into a system like that and you're sitting there and then you're looking at half your therapist squad have worked themselves so hard for 30 plus years, some longer, and done it with their heart and soul that they've taken themselves to this depressed era to where they're still chugging forward because they really love their patients. But they're about ready to give up their own lives, if not missed it already. Then the other half is the young ones coming in trying to change the world that are being told, no, you got to do it within this box.
Oh, yeah.
And they're waking up to it at the same
time. Right,
yeah.
Yeah, you come in with the fire. You know, you're brand new. You want to change something. And it just slowly suppresses. Just like that. And a lot of these, I think a lot of these programs are, you know, They start out with good intentions, but then they end up being self-serving. Don't they? I mean, it's pretty much it, you know? All of the government programs like that. They end up with good intentions, but then they end up, you know, being self-serving, meaning, the people that work in the institution itself or the program, they benefit highly from it, right? And so, you know, usually when it fails or anything like that, they demand more funding. Right. And where does the funding go to? Does it really help the patients or, you know, the people that it's supposed to help? Not really. It doesn't. The more funding goes to it, it doesn't help. I mean, we can relate that to the educational system and everything, but talking about the drug rehab centers right now, you know, you're getting funding for it and it's just not working. And nobody wants to offer better ideas. I don't know. What's going on?
Well, they're not accepted. Well, here's another kind of bit of information is, you know, you kind of talk about the top-down theory, you know, a little bit of top-down where throwing the money at it to try and, well, there's also the bottom-up where there was never enough funding to begin with, that there was, you know, like you had 22 people in a group, you know, that's difficult to work with. That's difficult to get any sort of work with done with any individual. So I think sometimes that the system is overwhelmed at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like so many other areas in business and life, the idea is to throw more money at it. And I think money is a big factor in it because you have to have the money to be able to pay qualified therapists, to pay qualified administrators, to even pay enough to have enough of them to where you don't have 22 people per therapist, or you probably ran groups with two.
Never that low.
That, really?
No, it would be, the lowest I would see would be probably 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd range 8 to 22.
Well, I mean, all the
and it would only range to the main point because the therapist would have quit.
5 to 8 people is the most you ever should have in a therapy group. And
I don't know what the Medicare
level is. So it's right hard now to tell because you do have, you know, a lot of times patients, customers that don't have the money to pay for service, but somebody has to provide them service because if not, you become a lot of social problems with the legal system, stealing, you know, all of the things in terms of the social environment. So somebody has to stop in to help them. And I think that's a lot of the problem, especially why it doesn't get privatized, is that businesses look at mental health and say, there's no profit to be made here. We'll be giving high salaries to mental health workers that deserve it and should have it because they do a really good job at what they do. But they look at it and say, if we pay these people to get quality people in here that are worth the money we're going to pay them, who's going to pay us? Where's the profit? You know, and I think that's why there are so many community health centers that provide help, but operate probably on difficult levels. So then you are left with that social problem. Then is it the free market or is it the government? And if it is the government, how can we make it to where the government can actually work effectively,
which it never has in the history of mankind? It's never going to. Mm-hmm. We'll have the debate, you know, nonstop for 100,000 years, and that people will refuse to acknowledge it because it just they can't think of anything else. They can't I mean, like just like the welfare system here, right? Nobody, everybody, wow, we need help. Guess what? We never had a welfare system the first 150 years in our country, mm-hmm. you know? What happened then? Was there people, you know, mm-hmm. starving in the streets? No. Communities, they took care of everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
Communities, you had volunteer, you know, institutions that sprung up to help, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But now we have, you know, all the government programs all around. I mean, there's what, thousands? Probably millions? I wouldn't even doubt it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are failing, if not all of them. I guarantee you, if somebody did the actual research and wrote a book about it, mm-hmm. I guarantee you that most of them are failing. But, you know, we can't put our minds to the possibility of maybe the community or the free market or even volunteer, even charities mm-hmm. can take care of this stuff. We just can't think that. We always think of government doing mm-hmm. it, even though they don't,
mm-hmm.
you know? And society suffers for it all the time.
Do you think there can be a happy medium between a government like a non-for-profit and a privatized company? Can we like do something to where there's emergence of them in the middle for the greater good, where both of them have to give a little bit?
But isn't that what's happening right now? Doesn't all the governments just subcontract out little, you know, private companies?
Good
private
point.
Companies who get paid a lot of money from the government, who steal from us to do it?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's the basic concept is you know, I'm a big libertarian, right? I truly believe society would function better based on voluntary interactions. I just do, you know. And I think history backs it a little bit, you know. I mean, with the government programs and all the stuff that's failed. But, you know, government survives solely on what?
Tax
the money
and knowledge.
It takes from the people, right? And it has a monopoly of force. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a better way to do that? Couldn't society function on a voluntary basis?
Explain that. Go. Tell
you
me.
What I mean? So what is government? Right? Government has a monopoly of force, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it does, right?
Yeah.
Anything it has to steal or take from the subjects, right? The people that work. So, you know, it takes the money, it steals money. And what I'm getting at is the non-aggression principle. Are you familiar with that?
No, fill me in.
It's pretty much the non-aggression principle is pretty much the idea that, you know, get my words right here. We deal with
what's cool is you don't have to worry about PC on this shit at all.
Yeah, I know.
You can just fucking say it,
I know.
Man. That's the cool part.
I'm trying to get the words right.
Don't worry about it. just be the word.
What libertarianism is, it's we're dealing with force, right?
Mm-hmm.
When is force, I guess, morally justified? You know, if you ask
that's
the
subjective.
Average person,
that's subjective.
When is violence force
right.
morally justified?
Some would say never. Some would say depends. Right. It's subjective.
But you would say most people would be like in self-defense, right?
Sure. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't initially aggress against somebody,
right?
Like, you know, you wouldn't go to your neighbor and be like. Kind of like this,
sure, we fight that. It's called bullying, right? We fight that these days. That's right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's what libertarian is basic. Is basically it's basic. We
sure.
believe that, you know, the non-aggression principle, right? Force violence is evil, right? Unless it's self-defense.
Gotcha.
Right. Well, government is the biggest enabler of or the breaker of non-aggression principle because it functions through violence on everything, no matter taxation. Through Medicaid, I mean, everything, dude. Force, you know, military, everything. It survives solely off of it breaks the non-aggression principle. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. I think society could function better as a voluntary society.
I mean, I can connect that.
Voluntary interactions, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I can connect that because
on a daily basis, we do it all the time.
Oh, well, you're talking about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. I mean, from me as a therapist, what I saw when you asked what are the recovery rates, I would tell you that the recovery rate percentage is based directly off the intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. If the patient or the person that is wanting to change their behavior is motivated intrinsically and is willing to change anything and adopt any belief at a time to make this change happen and what they believe to be good, then that, to me, is what separates the difference between the patient in or out of any program or system. You know, I'm a fan of whatever works for you. But if you're motivated extrinsically, what I like to say is extrinsic motivation can be good because it can lead you to the water. But what I say is that without intrinsic motivation, you still don't drink the water. And there are millions laying dead next to the water. Right? So the extrinsic motivation will bring you there. But unless you're motivated inside to make that change, right?
Right.
And in this libertarian sense you may be speaking to, could be unless the person feels an intrinsic motivation to volunteer their self or sacrifice to a point, mm-hmm. to better a community or a connection, then truly it's not motivated by real love in any way. And
right.
so it has to be motivated by or aggression or financial gain or power in some sense. And so that notion is, and I can connect that to why they allow a system that they know has a very small recovery rate, if not addicts more people than it
yeah.
does cure people or treat, if you will, or help people, meaning there is no cure. You know, so what do we do? And so you're locked down in a 30-day facility.
Mm-hmm.
That seems aggressive to me. So locking someone down in a facility, heck, there was a facility here in Orlando that I was almost taking part in working at, and until I saw child restraints.
Mm.
Now, I saw child restraints at a place that's rather popular, and I thought, we're still restraining children. And now these are not weapon-holding,
right.
these are five-year-olds. These are seven-year-olds. These aren't people we're going to, you know,
yeah.
stress at this point. Now, when you see that, you go, okay, this is aggression.
Mm-hmm.
This is a threat of aggression that unless you subserve to the cookie-cutter lifestyle of what we think you
yeah.
should be at this point, then there must be something wrong with you,
right.
a.k.a. a diagnosis shortly
mm-hmm.
follows. You know, and the line in the sand I drew on the show that can help, you know, still connect in your principle is, you know, I drew that line in the sand that there wasn't a difference, you know, and there is that difference there. But that aggression principle, I can see it speaks to that, but unless you're intrinsically motivated to want to make the change. And if we do really want to change things in this country, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be an intrinsic volunteer thing.
Got to. It puts the soul back in humanity. You know? I mean, what happens in the last probably, even 100, probably 50 years, you know, the communities are just, we're just not entwined anymore. You know what I mean? We don't want to take care of our neighbor anymore. We don't want to be involved with each other anymore. We're kind of just, we're kind of just robots, actually. You know, soulless. You know, we do our thing. We go to work. We come back, pay taxes. We don't care. We don't care about the poverty people. Hey, they're getting taken care of, right? Charities, I don't need to donate. Taxes take care of that. You know, so it kind of takes the soul and the humanity out of all of it.
The responsibility.
You know what I mean? Exactly. You know, back in the day, we were close, right? We were close. We didn't have, you know, government in our life hardly at all back in the day, you know, and communities took care of each other. We were actually involved in each other's lives, and I don't think the depression rate was skyrocketed or, you know, I'm not blaming all that on that, but I'm just saying, you know, society's evolving. You know, we live in the richest country in the world. We have everything, and it just seems like we're torn apart more than ever. Why? We're divided over Republican and Democrat. Why is that?
It does seem rather dualism. It does see it like
more
a dualism.
Than ever.
Especially in the
more than
past
ever.
3 years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who would have saw the race riots like that's going on, you know? The race stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It died down for a while. It's never been eliminated.
Well,
it died down for a while. Now it's just zoof. I mean, it's crazy, man.
And it's true. I mean, but
everything. Our relationships are politicized.
Mm.
That's what it is. Everything. We get in our little identities. You know, we got our, you know, this group over here, this group over here, and then everybody's enemies. Because the government's benefiting somebody at the expense of somebody else. So we look at them as enemies, right?
These are distractions. For me, it's look over here, look
right.
over here. You know, the racism stuff is real. I mean, there are more blacks being killed and targeted by police. I mean,
100%.
These are real.
100%.
But in a sense, these are still symptoms. And the problem is these are heartfelt symptoms. People feel close to them because we've lost lives to them. It's close to me, the drug rehab facilities, because I have friends that have been through it and family members.
Yeah.
We all do. It's hard pressed to find someone that doesn't have someone that hasn't been touched by alcoholism or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why it's a sensitive subject to talk about how those treatment facilities are there, because they do help some people.
Right.
But I've noticed it also has helped more people that have a support system. And then what we talk
mm-hmm.
about, Doc,
mm-hmm.
is we're worried about the support system. And so, Eric, you're speaking to the idea of a community support system that creates itself. Well, I know, we both know as professionals in the industry at one time for me directly, was your support team that awaits you on the outside is huge.
One of the most important factors in prevention of relapse.
It is. And so that it's not there. The family support's not there. You know, I know the people that left any rehab that, you know, I was at and treating them, I knew if they were at least going home to a mother and father that were there supportively and not enabling in a way, but were supportive and working with them, that their success rate went through. It went through the roof, went up. And let's face it, a lot of the ones that I was seeing, there is no support group, there is no support team, there is no community, as you say, Eric. It's not there. It's non-existent. And so we create subgroups and sub-societies, AA, NA. We create these sub-societies for them to attach themselves to, right?
Mm-hmm. Here's a question for you. Yeah, this will be an interesting one. You'll like this.
Get it, baby.
Did you find that the overall success rate for people who were enabled by parents, friends, or had an enabler were higher relapse rates for them or higher relapse rates for those who had absolutely no support system and went back out on their own with really nobody and nothing?
The ones with no enabler had a much better chance than those
staying sober.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Than those that have the enabling mother or father or sister or aunt or uncle or friend.
I found that too.
Did you?
Absolutely. I see it in all over.
It's strange though. You know, but
I think it's the intrinsic too. You know, one of the things is they're forced to be more intrinsic because their extrinsic life is nothing. They don't have anything. So they're not really influenced by that. They have to look inside of themselves. They're forced to because that's all they really have. And I think when you get out of rehab and you know that you have a house to come to, you know you have parents who are going to be there. You know they're going to give you money and give you gas money and give you money to go to McDonald's if you ask them to.
Yep.
And you can drive to your drug dealer's house with $20 in your pocket and not come home for 3 hours from McDonald's. I find that those have the higher fail rates.
Oh.
Now they'll keep going back into it because they have the resources to do it, where sometimes you have to hit rock bottom. And I find that it's parents or friends or family or that enabling support group that prevents people from hitting rock bottom. And it comes kind of back to their responsibility, too, of you have to have personal responsibility of yourself. And I feel like, in good substance abuse programs, they try not to enable them. They try not to include the family quite like that. But they try and get the family to go because you have to hit rock bottom in order to, everybody's rock bottom is different, but you have to hit your rock bottom in order to build back up. You know, you have to say, stop blaming other people, stop blaming mom, dad, things for that and look at yourself that at the end of the day, you're the one who chose to use the drugs, the substances, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that, you know, a lot of people out there struggle with problems due to their mom and dads and families like that, but just taking personal responsibility for yourself is really what I'm saying.
And a lot of that was my argument on Rogan and was, I got so caught up in I think the rhetoric that I was chose to become at that moment that, you know, it was slipping by the personal choice that which it is, but also it was a symptom. I fucking stressed that notion of the drugs themselves to me, and even to speak to your point, the racism, these notions, these are symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer we continue to fight symptoms, we're missing the entire picture.
Right.
And so we're seeing, I would see a 98% return in 3 months on my original patient roster.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the drug's this, the drug's that, but no, this is a symptom because the person has not dealt with or learned how to be a person and has been through some things in their past that these drugs are filling.
Right.
But we get so focused on wanting to fix the symptom because it seems easy. You can blame the heroin. You can point at the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And we get, you know, so fixed on that notion. And so it shouldn't be drug rehab facilities. It should be, you know, person rehab facilities. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not rehabbing someone off the drugs as I am rehabbing the individual.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, where I believe it lies. Like, that's why I think it speaks to your principle, is that if the person, one, has to be intrinsically motivated to see past the symptom of all of the rhetoric, whether it's disease or non-disease, whether the boxing works or doesn't, past all that rhetoric, and see really to that idea of, A, the choice, but also it's not about how you're handling the symptom of drug addiction, but how you're handling what's causing the symptom of drug addiction.
Right.
What's causing that is what's missed. And the system that is organized now is organized only to treat symptoms. And like I argued on the show, is if we continue to fight a sore throat while we have a bacteria infection, then we will all die.
Yeah. Here's part of the problem with some of that is that you are right. You know, we do treat the addiction and not so much the symptom.
And we're taught differently,
right? And a lot
right?
of times, well...
Aren't we taught that we get them off the drugs and then we treat the person?
I don't think we are, but I think the system does. You
okay.
know, that when we come in, let's say I've worked in a 30-day treatment center, I know you
have. Well, if you had a dual diagnosis patient, they came to you on heroin and they came to you dealing with situational depression, what do you treat first?
Well, here's the problem, is... they tell you you have 30 days to begin with.
Sure.
Do what you can do with this person in 30 days. You can't solve these problems in 30
yes,
days.
Yes,
and it's
sir.
Not even healthy to do therapy every day with the patient. That is not what's best with these people, that it takes them a little bit longer term treatment. And
agreed.
They say that you have 30 days, right. do the best you can. So what do you do in 30 days? You try to do the best you can, and the best you can is to get them off of drugs, and you have to use behavioral regimens to do it,
mm-hmm.
and not go so much into treating the symptom, but trying to disinfect the cut, trying to take care of the cut, trying to nurture the cut,
yeah.
but not really healing
right.
the cut. And that's where a lot of the problem comes in, is that it's not so much... You know, therapy works. All the research
yeah.
shows that, and the therapy works even with medications. And
works better.
Works better.
That's the research.
However, long-term therapy shows better results with long-term therapy than with, you know,
short-term
medication.
Pharmacology.
Or long-term pharmacology.
Thank you, sir. High five over the
that,
microphone. Thank
that
you.
Therapy alone has better long-term results than the medication and all of that put together. But we can't do that because they say you have 30 days to
right.
fix this. So it's triage. It's
yeah,
triage.
That's it. That's
you get
that's
injured
that's
in
that's
the
that's
war.
It.
You come
right.
to me, I wrap up your arm and say, hey, man,
yeah.
get back out there. You're good now.
Yeah. yeah.
And,
yeah,
and you go back.
This guy, so.
But you know that you're not 100%
right.
good. But you go out and fight the best battle you can fight with what you have. And I think that's really where the system fails, and maybe, you know, that's kind of where more of some of the bureaucracy and the government plays a role, and maybe insurance companies as well.
Yeah. Which are, you know, in bed with each other, right?
That's
true.
Yeah. Well, you know, Medicare, most insurance companies base their models off of what Medicare does. And that is kind of the model for healthcare, is that they all kind of watch what Medicare does and they make their adjustments based off of that. So.
It's a lot to absorb. I mean, it's too much. I'm surprised your libertarian ass isn't going off right
now. I'm drug rehab learning right here. That's all I'm doing right here.
But it, for me, if anything can, at least you're right, the longer term therapy is really
we worked on the front lines.
It's true. It's really the trenches front lines, man. And I would agree with you completely that the longer term is necessary. But even to put terms on it is even wrong. You know, Portugal decriminalized everything and their violence rate went down. You know, the drug use rate went down.
Undeniable.
Crime went down.
And everywhere, even Colorado.
And they decriminalized it, and then what they did is they took all that money they
yeah.
saved and put it in toward offering good help.
Right.
And now the help is sought out with an intrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, as a practitioner of any kind, if a patient or a person or a client is coming to me and is intrinsically motivated for their change, then I know the chances that
yeah.
they have has fucking tripled,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever, doubled. you know, what we're going to do. But if I start beginning to apply enabling methods, A, such as medication, especially when it's not necessary.
Right.
You don't need Suboxone to detox from heroin. It's not necessary. True, it's not like having the flu, like Joe said,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Carl Hart may allude to, unless they've had a really bad flu. I mean, it can, at the moment, it can feel truly like you want suicide can be better.
Yeah, yeah.
But as long as you know in your mind that death is not what's coming and you're monitored in the proper way, you know, why put something else in the way?
Right.
That now you become, well, without this pill now, I can't stay sober. I mean, one, you can't be sober. You can't take an opiate every day and say you're sober.
Yeah.
You know, but the whole picture is missing the person and really having an individualized treatment, as we like to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's not individualized. It's a group therapy session anyway, and this modality speaks to be not very constructive for this group, this demographic, I would argue. Let's pretend people dealing with the same shit around each other. So what do we do? So what do we do? I mean, you know, he asked me that. What do you do?
Yeah.
What's the step to changing anything that has to do with that? What would you do? What would you do to treat him? See, it's...
That is the question we're left with, is what's next? What do we do? What direction do we
sure.
go to? I think anytime you use, an alternative form, which, you know, things like methadone and Suboxone and things like that, you know what they do. They fill up those receptors that prevent the use of opiates, but then you prolong the withdrawal symptoms and, you know, good facilities will wean you off of those.
That's right. Now, I'm going to ask you, is Suboxone meant to be taken for life?
I don't think anything should be meant to be taken for life.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of people out there who do need medications for life, and it should be taken appropriately. But I think in terms of the use of Suboxone or any of the, you know, methadone, there's a goal. There should be a goal. You know, I know there's people out there who need antipsychotics, antidepressants, and I encourage certain people to be on those.
I would too.
But I think when it comes to Suboxone or methadone, there's more. There's another step, you know, that, yes, it can help prevent them from doing certain things or experiencing certain things, but I think there has to be an end goal. There's got to be an addition to it.
What would be the end goal for you, Eric, on a vision? Yeah, where do we start?
Rehab?
Anything for you, whether it's a rehab, whatever. Where would you start in a vision of what you may see as broken?
Well, I just found out how bad it's broken.
Even more so.
I don't know. I figured it was broken. But, you know, listen.
Well, we started a conversation. We started a conversation earlier.
Yeah.
If one of your family members had an issue with drugs, what would your risk?
You know, initially, you would do everything in your power to see what's going on, you know? You want to find out first, you know, how long it's been going on. You just like you always say, you want to treat the underlying condition of what happened, you know. I mean, that's a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want that.
Right.
But, you know,
I'll give you a better example to help you answer it. And maybe Doc can play this example in your life. Because you've seen the patients do it. And, you know, I'd be interested to know what percentage you thought in your group of 10 were there not because they had an underlying issue of a past life, but because they just had surgery or something just happened,
yeah.
and next thing you know, they were just taking some pills and they lost their whole life and fell apart.
I've heard of it.
You know, that's a smaller percentage of the group, but that's definitely happened.
It happens.
So in your sense, Eric, and the question I ask you is, let's just assume that it happened that way. One of your children was injured or something, nothing tragic or nothing mm-hmm. hardcore, but got on some pain pills to a point and then just couldn't get off. What would you do?
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, you try to treat the underlying condition at home at first, but then you'd have to get help from someone.
Okay.
You know, if it failed, right?
Sure.
You know, and it...
But the average person who doesn't know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, go ahead.
You wouldn't, I just wouldn't want to send them off to some kind of rehab, you know, facility. I wouldn't feel comfortable with that. But like counselors or, you know, something that I'm involved with, you know what I mean? Not just
Now you see the end result of this. I mean, you're a paramedic.
Right.
I mean, you see the end of it. I mean, you see the end result of broken systems, bad treatment facilities, bad parenting, educate, whatever, bad choices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so for you, I'm letting them know that you see that at its bloody end, literally.
Oh yeah, all the time. All the time. You know, you see, and I work at the airport. You know, you wouldn't think that you'd see a lot of stuff out there, but you do all the time. And, heroin overdose is common out there. It's common. And, you know, recently, overdose, right there at the airport.
Tell me
that. You know, and it's just some dude.
What happened?
You know, and pretty much we have drugs to push to, you know, kind of block out the heroin.
What happened? Like,
he was just in the bathroom and just.
You showed up on scene.
Yep, showed up on scene. Pretty much he coded. You know, he's dead. You know, he had needles in his pocket and, you know, all that stuff. It's common, man. Paramedics see it all the time. You know, so that's why when you guys were talking about it, I was just, you know, you guys are talking about the drug rehab, but you know, you get to see the stuff where they're on their last leg. They're on their last breath, or it is their last breath. You know what I mean? So.
Could this be an argument then for the boxer? You know, could the boxing have helped that guy?
Well, we push the drug and it blocks out, right? It blocks, it erases the heroin from, it just.
What do you do? What is it? What do you give them?
Well, you start an IV,
mm-hmm.
and it's called Narcan. It's a drug called Narcan. You push it in, blocks out, it pretty much just blocks the heroin influence on, you know, mm-hmm. cells and everything. And the dude just pretty much just goes, hey, what's up? He talks just like that. Like, dude, you know where you're at? He's like, yeah, fucking, I'm in Orlando. Fucking, I know exactly where I'm at. Knows exactly everything. It was just, and he was dead. He was dead 5 seconds ago. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And he knows. What? Just like that.
What?
Yeah, you're breathing for him, bro. You're fucking breathing for him. He fucking wakes up, bro. He knows everything.
But you gotta reach him at the right time.
Right.
Yeah.
What's
of course, you know.
What's the time frame?
Well, hell, you need oxygen, right?
How long till? What's your time frame to get there?
Oh man, you gotta get there with 5 minutes, you know, 5 to 10 minutes.
So is that an argument then for the boxing? Does the boxing help this guy?
It has a time and place. It has a time and place for people. You know, I think to help this guy, yeah, but I don't think, you know, what type of life is he living to live off of it? You know, if he can make it work, yeah, but I think, you know, I don't see a lot of people who make it continue on that. I think the long-term Suboxone users continue to struggle, and they're going to continue to struggle, and sometimes maybe in a worse way, because now they're taking Suboxone and having to experience a lot of that, you know, so they're just living with the symptom. And unless you get help, once again, the help with the symptom, you have somebody who's on Suboxone who I find usually kind of goes off of it at some point.
Yeah.
Methadone as well. At some point, they... You know, you continue on methadone, and unless you slowly lean off of it and, you know, kind of integrate back into not having an idea of life, at some point I see people relapse again, even off of that.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to point out on the show.
There's a time and place for the Suboxone. I think you have to have a doctor who's well-trained and in a good place for it, and highly monitored. But until then, you know, it's a... needs to be kind of monitored.
And that's the thing, is they're not monitored. They're put, you know, they go live in a halfway house upon discharge. So, I mean, put yourself in the situation. Who knows? You've been there doing it 8 years, 5 years, right? You've had enabled support to where mom and dad picked you up sometimes, moved you on. You had an odd job here and there. You sold some drugs in between all that. You know, nothing's really going for you to this point, right? Maybe you even picked up Hep C along the way. Right? And this is the life, it's rampant in that, right? It is. And so you pick this up along the way. Now, this is what your life's come to. This is your third rehab facility. Your parents now have done the intervention thing and told you this is it for you. So now your only love and support has been cut. They're going to let you hit rock bottom. But rock bottom now brings you into a facility, gives you 30 days, changes out some medications, now screws up your chemical balance in 30 days. Hopefully we've balanced it. For now, go live in this house with about 4 or 5 other people that are dealing with your same idea. Have some freedom in between here. Come to this place for, you know, half the day and talk about it. Go to this meeting at night. You probably can't get a job because if you do, it may pay you more and your disability's gone. So I can't really go get a job.
Or you miss meetings.
And I miss meetings. And then if I miss meetings for work, that's not okay. And now I got money, and they tell me money's bad. And then if I got money right away, I can't afford the medications they've given me anyway, so I have to stay on disability, so I have my Medicare D plan, so it makes my medications affordable. So I have no reason to get off of disability because I lose my Medicare Plan D possibly, especially if I have income coming in. Now, some people let you make $1,000 on top of your disability check. But really, disability $700, I can make $1,700 a month,
yeah.
And $300 of that is gone to medication already. And if I got Medicare Part D, it's not. But at least now I got 150 pills that I could sell for money, not sell for money, do for fun. I can't really have a job. And what's the number one cause for doing drugs? Boredom, regret, shame.
Boredom is one of the worst.
That's right. And so my idea is not that the person or the addict is the one that's caught up in this five-star Ritz-Carlton system. Is the idea that some understand the system and choose to be and think they should be treated certain ways. Some don't know and get caught in the system and have no idea why.
Mm-hmm.
Parents and families and brothers and sisters that did what they thought they were supposed to do have now wound up on their hands with, we don't know what to do. And the person themselves are so lost in the system of pills and diagnosis and disability checks and Hep C and other diagnoses and things that are acquired in this system. And no one's changing a fucking thing. We're giving more money to it. We're just throwing more money at mental health. It's great that it's aware, but we're throwing more money at a broken system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're doing. More money at a broken system, man. I mean, we got like a minute left. And then
well, I think one of the problems is just that we haven't come up with something better yet. You know, and it's up to us. It's up to people to do that. You know, it's up to coming up with ideas, talking about it, starting a dialogue, getting it out there just like we did tonight.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, it's true that if you had to kind of leave something out there to connect, yeah. Eric, what
well,
would
you know,
it?
I mean, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program, and most government programs start out temporarily, right? And, you know, they end up, like I said earlier, serving themselves, you know? And when the system's broken, you know, they're just going to keep on working broke. That's what they do. That's what all of them do. You know what I mean?
And I think people are the same way.
Right. You know, and, you know, they might change protocols a little bit. You know, they might change small things. They're not going to do a drastic change, though. You know what I mean? So.
I think that's where it speaks to the individual has to be willing to make the drastic change. We as individuals, we as communities have to be willing to make the drastic change.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, my answer to if my daughter was affected by that was if I got to live out a cardboard box handcuffed to my daughter.
Right.
That's what I'm doing until we work through this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'm the issue and I handcuffed to my wife. But
right,
my point.
But it's education, right?
That's
right. People just break away from what they think they know about stuff. Boom.
Be
you know?
Willing to change what you believe and know.
If you know this system is failing, why would you ever go there? Or you know, I know some people don't have a support group, and that you know they just kind of end up there. But a lot of people,
I'll argue at least it's something. I'll argue at least it's something.
Even though you know it fails,
at least it's something. But I'm with you.
Yeah.
That's why I said what I said on Rogan, man. Doc, close this out.
Sounds good. You clarified a lot of that. Sounds good.
Hey, I want you to check out another podcast that I listen to with two friends of mine. That's my buddy Chris Fisher and his friend Jesse Cage in the FNK podcast. You can catch them at fisherandcage.com, but look them up on iTunes. They're a great podcast. I love listening to the fellas each week, but that's the FNK podcast.